This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This show is brought to you by GoPays, providing accessible, affordable, and inclusive digital financial services, all in one app, all also okay.
It's 7:07 on the evening edition with Hezril and Kelvin. This is the second episode of our five-part series on financial innovation and accessibility. For the next few Fridays at 7 p.m., we're going to look at understanding different parts of the financial system and how banking can be made easier and better. Last week, for instance, we touched on the introduction of banking to Malaya in its early days.
Yep, and today we're going to be talking about how banking has changed over the years, specifically how it evolved from checkbooks and bank books to the online payment systems we have today. So we're going to get a historical look from how that transition happened and also to hear about what it was like going from over-the-counter services to ATMs.
Yep, and to do all that, we're joined now by a retired banker who's worked in the field for many years, but for the sake of privacy, wanted to remain unnamed. So we'll be addressing him simply as Dato for this interview. Thanks so much for joining us, Dato. How accessible was banking in Malaysia in the early days of the country during the 1960s and 70s?
It was not easily accessible. The bank branches were mostly in the major towns. There were very few in small towns and in rural areas. It's a set of context. Before 1957, there were very few commercial banks in operation. Branches of foreign banks, mostly British, were opened in major cities. Example, Penang, Malacca and Ipoh. And Chinese businessmen and Indian traders, they also set up a few local banks. Example, Kongit Bank and Panghilin Bank. And again, these are mostly in major towns. If you look at the year we have Merdeka, there were 26 banks with 111 branches, but mostly in high street and in major cities, right? And then they were supporting the Malayan economy, which is agriculture and mining based. And in the year 1970s to 1990s, there were major expansion of branches, both in big towns, smaller towns, and rural areas. This is to support the economy, which was moving towards industrialization and manufacturing. And as a result, in 1978, you find we have 37 commercial banks, 509 branches. And in 1996, we have 37 commercial banks with 1,569 branches. So there was this big expansion of branches towards the 1970s to 1990 versus the early years.
Right. So you touched on the expansion of these branches for rural people living in Malaysia. What else was done to make it more accessible for those populations?
Actually, this question is interesting because of Maybank, at least I know, the founder was Khoo Teck Puat. He founded the bank in 1960, and he was very far-sighted. He opened many branches in smaller towns, like Kuala Pilah, Tampin, right? By opening branches at coffee shop, right? That means if you see a coffee shop, he acquired a coffee shop and opened a branch there. And that's why they're known as a coffee shop bank. And that's the way, at least, the big local bank expanded to reach the rural area. But that's a traditional banking. Maybank also was innovative at the time in the early part of the 70s and 80s. They started mobile banking, not the mobile banking that you know now.
Yeah, which was what I was about to ask.
Not the mobile banking through the handphone. They actually installed a bank in the bus, which went to new villages, you know, because at that time, new villages, they don't have banks, and to smaller towns and rural areas. And this bus banking, so to speak, provide basic banking facilities like saving account FD. So these are probably two examples which I can mention how they went to the smaller town and rural areas.
Generally speaking, what did banks need to take into account before introducing new services to their customers?
So the key consideration as banker, I think, is to look at risk. I think that is very important. The bulk of business is loan. So credit risk is very important. For deposit, payment, remittance, and investment, I think here itself we are very particular about risk to customer. Example, when money is remitted, we will have to ensure that the correct person receives the money. The other considerations are generic to any other business, right? Is 101. First question, we will ask, is there a demand for such a service? I give you an example. If there is not a proper study done, you find that sometimes bank introduce services later which fail because there's no demand. Mm. Example will be when they open a cafe next to a banking hall. It's very sexy, very cool, but when it's rolled out, you find that this so-called cafe is not really in demand. It doesn't add value. And you notice over the past few years, banks that have introduced cafe next to the banking hall close to all those cafes. Second one is, of course, we need to know how big is the market, look at the ROI, cost versus return. A good example is ATM. So at one time, some banks, including Maybank, we put a lot of ATM in malls, petrol kiosks. But over time, we found that really the cost became exorbitant. We had to put more security to protect the ATM. We outsourced the replenishment of cash. So when we did our numbers, we found that the returns doesn't make sense. And as a result, banks have started to rationalize. Meaning they do not put too many ATMs in malls, in petrol kiosks. And even they go to the extent of sharing the ATM costs through Maps. For example, Maps now install the machine, and these are used by all banks, and they charge all customers. The other area which is peculiar to banking, more emphasis is regulation. Things like foreign exchange control. One example I would say is that people actually pay more money into their credit card access. The idea is to withdraw the money overseas, try to bypass all this foreign exchange. And I think later on, their authorities were alerted to stop such practices of overpaying your credit card so that you can withdraw overseas. So these are the things we do take into consideration.
Now, talk to us about when checkbooks and bankbooks were first introduced to Malaysia. What was that like, Dato? And how did people respond at the time?
Actually, the checkbook and saving passbook were already in existence before Merdeka. They were brought to our country through the foreign banks, like example, the British Bank, Chartered Bank, and Hong Kong Bank. And as time goes by, people started to use more and more of checks because of banking services available there to them now that they are open in more towns and villages. And of course, checks are popular because you don't need to carry a lot of cash, and saving to a bank is also obviously very safe. Because I heard story, actually, even in KL, there was one heritage building. They tore it down. They found that they were actually money on the rooftop. Whoa. Because people keep it up in the air, right? But with the advent of banking, I think these people started to put in the bank rather than to put cash on the roof. So, and when they started to put money in the bank, of course, the passbook become important because of the record. It's a source of recording for them. The other area in terms of checks, just to give you insight, interesting, is those days checks were also popular because of the check butt, right? It's a form of recording for people. They don't have internet banking now. You can check online, right? So one way for them, while waiting for the manual statement to be sent to them, they actually look the checkbook but to record the transaction so that they do not overdraw the account, right? So this is an interesting insight, which I recall. Checkbook buts were very critical at the time. And then just to share with you also, in terms of the passbook, those days you don't have computerization. You use the NCR machine to update the records, right? So people actually use the passbook to see their saving, how much they have saved, what's interest. So it was something which was a source of comfort for them.
And then, of course, we went on to have the ATMs introduced here. Could you tell us what it was like when ATMs were first introduced? How did that change accessibility for customers?
I joined the banking industry in 1981. And just before I joined, I heard stories going around that, hey, banks in overseas actually use machine to dispense cash. It sounds like a really crazy idea, right? Because at the time, we haven't seen such a thing before. Imagine going to the wall, you punch into the thing, the machine can dispense money. But I was lucky. Maybank was the first one to introduce ATM into the banking ampang. And actually, I can see really the effect of ATM, right? Onto the customers and to even to the bank. One, it's really convenient to customers. They don't need to queue. They can go to withdraw money anytime after banking hours. There were also less pressure for the tellers. Right? I remember those days when there was no ATM. When you go to a bank, during payday, they will have probably the full banking hall is full of people. And the pressure on the tellers were tremendous. Mm. And during lunchtime, you see, you really have to manage the queue. Customers get very upset if they're slow. So these were the impact I saw. Right? But there are other things which is quite interesting. One, during the time, to make sure that there's no downtime, people working in the bank have to come back to branch to open up the bank and replenish cash so that we make sure the ATM is up and running during a long weekend. Of course, now we don't have such problem because we outsource it to those people whose full-time job is to replenish cash. And also with the introduction of recycle machine. Now, this the same machine that dispense the cash can actually accept cash. Despite all this availability ATM, you won't be surprised. There's still some people who do not carry any ATM card because they just don't trust the machine. That's something I find very peculiar. In this time in Asia, there are still people who behave like that.
So you said you couldn't really quite believe it when you first heard about the ATM, and I assume that's also the case for the regular Joe as well. Back then, whenever a new service was introduced, what was the learning curve for customers?
In terms of the customer, there are some of those services they adopted very fast. For example, our computerized saving account and current account. I guess there's no choice because it was forced upon them, right? But there's some that take a bit more time, like the ATM and also the banker insurance, selling insurance to the bank. But the one that take a longer time was actually internet banking and mobile banking. This is very true for the older generation, right? And even my sister, only 1-2 years ago, she accepted the internet banking. In her case, she was not so much afraid of the security, but basically not used to new technology about mobile banking or even technology playing with the internet. But there are also people who still have some hesitation over the security. I guess this will take a while to convince them. The other one is bank selling investment structure product. So this will take a while because they need to understand the product. For the banking staff, they're that faster for various reasons. One, training is given. The training is very intensive. For example, when we do the ATM, I was given a lot of training. For insurance, banker, we were given a lot of training, even for the investment product. The second reason why they're that fast, they have no choice. Because if they don't learn the new skill, they're irrelevant. Even for bank, they must actually have a change management team or task force to drive it. Because if you don't do that, the adoption will slow. For example, when I was working in the bank, we were trying to move the people more to internet banking and mobile banking. The reason why is we are trying to decongest the branch more and also bring down our costs. Because as you know, cost is escalating rental and all that, staff costs and all that. But to make it happen, we just couldn't let BAU, business as usual. We had to form a task force whereby we tell the branch staff, hey, you yourself must adopt internet banking and mobile banking. The whole, or everyone in the branch must use it. So once you're familiar, then we say you can sell. Then once they're done, then we monitor. You say that everybody who open an account must have internet banking and if possible mobile banking. Then we monitor. So we really have to drive it. You can't leave it to BAU.
We're talking about the evolution of banking services in Malaysia with a retired banker. We'll be back to look at how these innovations have changed the way banks function and interact with its customers. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Stay tuned for more insights on GoPays, a universal e-wallet, all in one app. All also okay.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
We're back with more from GoPays, all in one app. All also, okay.
It's 7:22 and you're with Hezrul and Kelvin on the Evening Edition. It's the second episode over a five-part series on financial innovation and accessibility in Malaysia. We've been talking about how banking has evolved from checkbooks to ATMs to online banking. And joining us in the conversation is a retired banker who's had decades of experience in the field of banking. So he's asked to go unnamed because he wants to maintain a low profile, which is why we're just referring to him as Dato'. Dato, thanks for holding the line. So banks have increasingly moved away from face-to-face services, especially for everyday transactions. How has that affected the way banks work and function?
Wow. Actually, huge impact, right? Less and less people are coming to a banking hall. The people coming to banking hall is actually the SME business. They do collection in cash. They need to bank cash. Mm. So recently what we do is that we try to introduce the QR pay and also to offer merchant facilities to this small SME so that less cash is involved. And we hope that over time, the less cash will be transacted over the counter. Right? The other implication is since we are going into this IT-enabled banking system, we really have to pay attention to a few areas of IT, like resilience, security, cybersecurity especially, right? And for the staff, obviously, as I mentioned, they really need to reskill. We actually ask them to learn coding, you know, because we say if you don't learn coding, you may not be relevant, or else you have to go to sales. With the change of the banking, there's one area which probably also the bank has to change in terms of remuneration, right? Now that we have so-called employed mortgage consultant, right? Previously, housing loan was done by credit officer at the branch. You had to go to a branch to get a loan. But we found that during weekend, the developer launched the housing project. If we send our staff there, they're not really committed. They only spend 2 hours after they go back. Or the customers basically find no time to come to the bank. So then we employ mortgage consultant to basically go to the launcher so they have more or less flexi hours and they're paid based on commission rather than purely salary. There's basic salary and commission. The same applies to the new banking services of premium and private banking. We just can't go on the old remission. You can't attract the talent. Mm. So we also have to change the remission model. The other area of implication is we now have to recruit talents from overseas, especially those coders. And even we need to set up overseas lab like India, right, where we can recruit data scientists and people with new skills. So these are some of those things that changes with the introduction of all these services.
Right. And before a lot of these services, of course, were introduced back in 1959, Bank Negara was established. What was its early role and how did that help expand banking and financial services in the country?
I think the main role of Bank Negara was to supervise and regulate the business of financial institutions. Second role was to banker to the government and financial institution, banker of last resort. And later on, in the late 1960s, they also played the role of issuing the currency. Right? In terms of the supervision and regulation, I think the part here is more than supervision. Their role was also to initiate, encourage, and speed up the process of the diversified banking system. And I think they did well because, like I mentioned, in 1959, we have only 111 branches. But later on in the 1990s, we have 1,500 branches, I mean, more banks. Now, the part on regulation and supervision, I think banking, there's a need for strong supervision because you're dealing with money. And there is this systematic risk whereby if the banks tend to be reckless in lending, which happened, right, reckless spending or lending to cronies or relatives, then there will be losses and there will be a run in the bank. So I think Bank Negara did a good job in so-called spotting these potential dangers. And sometimes I think they will fine the banks, they will insist on change of management, even owners, to make sure that they are properly run. And as a result of all this strict supervision, there was a strong trust in the banking system. Mm-hmm. And I have to highlight one point here. We were lucky. I think 1959, we have a governor, I think Tun Ali. He was such a respected figure. And so it created a lot of fear because you must fear the regulators, right? He really was a person I heard. And if a person come late for the meeting, including the foreign bank CEO, he will shut the door and you can't even come in, right? And his so-called people that respect him so much, so I heard, that when he retired, right, he became chairman of Nan Bank, that when he comes in, the board of directors, which are all his Asian peers, they will stand up, right? So we are very lucky to have Tun Ali to be the governor. He set the standard. And until now, I think Banaka is still a very well-respected organization, very professional one.
So we've talked about a lot of history so far, and this series that we are currently running, it's quite focused on financial innovation and accessibility. What innovation do you think has made the biggest impact on consumers? And with all that you've said, with the amount of knowledge you have, what might be the next big one be?
When I look back the history, I think between 1960s to 1980s, there was not much innovation in the banking. But it was with the introduction of computerization and later internet that have the biggest impact to banking. Because with computerization, you can have ATM, you have the cash deposit machine, you have the check deposit machine, you have the cash recycle machine, right? It really brings convenience to the customer. And with internet banking and mobile banking, the convenience have brought it to a next level. Because now you can do banking almost anytime, anywhere. So I think these two, computerized internet banking, really have enabled the bank to go through many innovations. Now, as for the next big innovation, I'll probably mention two or three. The first one will be half the individuals are also probably SME owner, right? Previously, if you were to apply for SME loan, it will take 1 month, and you must have collateral, right? The banks are very strict. Now, with the advancement of the scorecard, now they come up with the retail scorecard for SME. Now people can actually get a clean loan from a bank up to 1.5 million and get it approved within 5 days and dispersed within 2 days. And this one, you don't need collateral and you don't even need audited financial statement. So it's really hassle-free and collateral-free. This really, for me, is something started a few years ago, but will continue to have a big impact, right? And later on, I suspect the bank will go down the value chain, meaning that not only the SME, but the micro SME. Now, the other area of innovation, or rather threat, is the fintech and big tech. Now, with fintech coming in, there's a lot of innovation because they move fast, right? They bring a lot of innovation. But from our observation, we don't think fintech will have a big impact to the bank, right? Because fintech actually solve a problem and they bring the problem to the bank to look for customer, right? They don't have a customer base, so they struggle. But what we are worried about is the big tech. The big tech, not only they have the deep pocket, the innovation, but they have the customer base. Example is Alibaba and Tencent. At the moment, if the government allow them to come to Malaysia, and allowed to do banking, I think this will have a big impact to banking because they will be probably giving more innovative solution, especially to the small SME owners, right? And they will also make better banking solution to the unbanked, right? So I think that is how I see it. The other area is more of technology. Previously, when you want to have a new system or new services, your IT people have to get vendor or do it in-house, but they need to integrate this into their core banking, which is a huge and big task, which probably take a few months to do it. But now, with the introduction of API, the bank has set the API, then they tell the API to all those application developer. They can actually come up with many, many applications because they're all fintech type, right? Basically what they do is that then the bank will say, okay, now that you follow my protocol, my API, all you need to do is to fit into our system. And that can be done much more faster. So with this system, it's something like Apple, having many, many apps into their services. So I think in the future, you'll find that more and more apps are available because of this development. You'll find more innovation coming to banking. So these three things probably, I say, will be something to watch out for.
Dato, thank you so much for those insights. We've been talking about how banking has evolved over the years, particularly with the advent of computerization. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
This show has been brought to you by GoPays, all in one app, all are so okay.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.